This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Although David Mamet says he wasn't a good actor himself, he's written for and directed great actors, including Joe Mantegna and W.H. Macy. Mamet says that a lot of what actors are taught is nonsense. He explains why in his new book, True and False, Heresy and Common Sense for the Actor. Mamet also has a new novel called The Old Religion, based on the 1914 trial of Leo Frank, a Jewish man unjustly convicted of murdering a girl in Atlanta. And Mamet has a new play called The Old Neighborhood that begins previews on Broadway next month. His earlier works include the plays Glengarry Glen Ross and American Buffalo. He wrote and directed the films House of Games, Things Change, and Homicide. His latest screenplay is The Edge. In his new book about acting, Mamet says that it's pointless for actors to use emotional memory and sense memory to try to become the character. It just doesn't work.
I've been working with actors for all of my life. I started out as a kid actor in Chicago and back around the turn of the century, and I've been attended many acting classes and taught many acting classes and have been directing actors for many, many years. And I started out, like all young actors do, confused, frightened, ambitious, and dedicated and wide-eyed, and went to a lot of acting classes where people of various stripes suggested and conducted exercises, the worth of which I couldn't see. And I felt very stupid because of it, and I felt stupid, talentless, and I realized when I started teaching, when I started working with actors, which I did very, very young. I started teaching acting in college when I was about 21 years old. I realized in attempting to implement these exercises as a teacher that they just didn't work, and that they could only be, their use could only be defended by the notion the truth will be revealed to you at some later date on the part of the teacher. And that further, that when one works with actors, whether as a director or as a teacher, what one is doing is creating physical habits. That's what a rehearsal period is about, and that's what a training period is about. It's not about creating ideas. It's about creating physical habits. And that if one creates the physical habit of doing something one doesn't understand in the hope that it will later be revealed, one becomes a gull and a patsy and has to live one's life in a state of self-loathing, because one is indulging in hypocrisy. So I try as a director, and I still teach, to work with actors in a way which is responsible, which is to say that if the actor doesn't understand the direction, or if the actor doesn't understand the exercise, if the actor doesn't understand the scene, it's not their fault, it's my fault. And then if I'm speaking in jargon, I'm probably lying. There's nothing in acting that a director can't, if the director can't express his or her thoughts succinctly in clear, unjargon-laden English, then they don't know what they're talking about.
Since you don't like the idea of the method or, you know, sense memory or, you know, becoming the character, what is your approach to teaching the craft of acting?
Well, the craft of acting, I think, is the components are fairly simple. One has to have excellent diction and a strong voice, a supple body, and one has to be able to analyze a scene very, very simply to answer the question, what's the scene about, so I know what I'm going to do in the scene. After that, one has to be able to do it. That is to say, to go into the scene and do nothing but that one thing the scene is about, to help out a friend, to put down an enemy, to clarify a situation, to draw the line, to make a contract, to forge a bond. These are all actable objectives. They're all and each something that a person can come into a room and do with no preparation. Anything one has to work oneself up into a state to do is not acting. And it's pretending. It's making funny faces and doing funny voices. And As I say in the book, what moves us in life is not people acting extraordinarily, but people acting fairly ordinarily in extraordinary circumstances. That is to say that what moves us in life, in real life, is not a person proclaiming their anguish or a person proclaiming their bravery, but the ordinary person who, without feeling like it, commits an act of bravery. A good example of that, a great example of that, is Rosa Parks, who just didn't get up off the bus. It's a great act of bravery. She didn't sit there and talk about the nature of injustice. She just said, what I'm feeling is nobody's business but my own, but I'm not moving. And if you look at the great actors of all time and the great actresses, that's what one sees in them, that what they're feeling is nobody's business but their own, but they ain't moving.
So how much do you describe to the actor in the script what might be going on in their mind, what their motivations are that they have not revealed to the character they're talking to?
I don't describe anything.
You don't describe any of that?
No, all the script's got is the words that they say.
Right. Because that's the kind of stuff that would be in a novel.
Exactly. And that's one way in which the novel, which is the epic form, deals differs from the drama, which is the dramatic form. The two completely different arts.
What are your auditions like? I mean, you've worked with some actors who I've always felt, you know, seemed born to do your plays and films. People like Joe Mantegna and William Macy. Mm-hmm. I know you found them pretty early in your career. I know Mantegna for sure was from Chicago. I can't remember with Macy. But when you're looking for actors now who you haven't worked with for that long, what do you look for? And how do you find it when you're auditioning?
Well, the best way to see what an actor can do is look at their work. You know, go see them in a play, go see them in a movie.
Right. As opposed to just doing an audition in the casting office.
Yeah, audition. I mean, it's audition is a barbaric process, and it's the way that most of them are held is, in my experience, not only barbaric but kind of useless, because what one doesn't want to do is ask the actor to come in. This is what almost all auditions are like. The actor, the actress, is asked to come in and do what they would do had they been hired. That is to say, the people want to sit back and say, okay, go up there now and do what I'm going to be seeing on opening night.
Mm-hmm.
Do what I'm going to be seeing in the movie. Well, the old adage in theater, and I think it's absolutely true, is the better an actor is, the worse they audition. And the reason is that what makes a good actor, a good actress, is somebody who's truthful, is somebody who's simple and truthful. And if you're coming to the audition, well, what you don't know what you're going to be doing on opening night. You haven't rehearsed the play yet, and more importantly, what you're going to be doing on opening night is going to depend on what the other actor or actress is doing on opening night. You're going to be playing the play with them, so that the audition, a process which pays off on show me, strut your stuff, is going to select for the second rate.
Mm-hmm. So do you not do those kinds of casting auditions at all?
No, I don't.
What are your rehearsals like when the actors are just getting acquainted with their lines and with the larger screenplay or play?
Oh, they're a lot of fun. My theory, my experience, and my practice is, why have a bad rehearsal? Doesn't make any sense, because you're going to perform what you rehearse. So if you rehearse being disappointed and trying to fill up the gap by adding effects, that's what you're going to perform. And you will carry with you through the rehearsal process and into performing a certain amount of self-loathing, which comes from your knowledge of your own hypocrisy. So rather than doing that, take it simple and say, okay, let's look at one scene at a time. What's the scene about? What are the characters doing? Let's do that. Fine, now I understand what it means to do that scene. Let's go do another scene. Let's go back to square one. What's the scene about? What are you doing in the scene physically? Are you trying to correct a flaw in another person? Are you trying to get a job? Are you trying to smooth out a disagreement? As I said before, these are all things which are active. One can actually do them. Try to get in touch with yourself is not something which anyone can do, an actor or not. It's not actable. So the process of the rehearsal process is to determine with the actors what are the actable actions in the scene and then practice doing them.
Give me more of a sense of what's not actable.
Okay, here's a sense of what's not actable. become a better person.
Mm-hmm.
Get in touch with yourself. See the light. Come to a clearer understanding. None of these things are actable. Open the window is actable. It's something that people can do.
Have you ever ended up casting an actor who you really liked in the previous production you saw, but then in working with them, you realize that their approach to acting is exactly the opposite of yours? They're into the method. They're into becoming the character. They're into trying to understand all the subtleties of the emotions the character is going into and playing that on stage.
Yeah, well, the actor's technique is really not my business. The actor's technique is his or her business.
Mm-hmm.
What's my business as the director is that the scene or the scene, whether on film or on stage, should be truthful. What the actor does to get there is their business. What's important to me is that the scene and each moment within the scene should be truthful.
So you'll never say to an actor, "Boy, you know, your approach to getting this character down is really troubling me because you're into all those things that I consider to be bogus approaches to acting." As long as the performance is good, it just doesn't matter how they got there. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right.
Right. Now, you write that you kind of caution actors not to worry so much about their talent or their lack of talent, but to just be as prepared as they can, to focus on their craft as much as they can, and to show up and be brave in the face of insecurity and just...
That's right.
And just do their best.
That's right.
I guess I'm wondering how much you think that acting is a question of a certain gift that you're just born with and how much of it can be developed through craft. And it's a question that can apply, I think, to any art. You know, how much of it is either you have it or you don't, and how much of it can actually be learned?
Well, I think that the difference between a good actor and a great actor is a question of a gift. I think that I've been looking at actors many, many, many years and watching them develop over many years. And what happens over the period of years is magical. I mean, sometimes people who were students of mine or people who I worked with, I've watched very closely, who I thought, quote, just didn't have it, end quotation, blossomed into superb and brilliant artists. And sometimes the opposite was true. People who had who it appeared to me had a great gift, for some reason didn't want to, didn't seem able to stay the course. I think that one has to stick with it, and that talent, I say in the book, that talent, a concern with one's talent is like a concern with one's height. It's trying to exercise a prerogative of the gods. It's already been exercised. You can't control it. All you can do is stick with it. And that sticking with it, being brave and being consistent and being prepared and being determined, will have great gifts, whether or not it will improve one's ability to act well or improve one's ability to act brilliantly. It will improve one's ability to get a job and to support oneself.
My guest is David Mamet. His new book about acting is called True and False. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with playwright, screenwriter, director, and novelist David Mamet. You have a new play. It's actually been performed before, but this will be its first time on Broadway, and it goes into previews November 11th. Tell us something about this play.
Well, this play is called The Old Neighborhood. And it's a play about a fellow who comes back to the old neighborhood for some semi-specified reason. And the first scene is he meets in his hotel room with his best friend. And the fellow who went away, the hero, Bobby Gould, played by Peter Riegert, obviously becomes very successful at something. We aren't quite sure what. And he meets with his best friend, played by Vincent Gustafero, who stayed in the old neighborhood and went into his dad's delicatessen. And they talk about being Jewish and what it means to have left and what it means to have stayed. And a play's called, subtitle of that play is The Disappearance of the Jews. And that's the beginning of this hero, Bobby Gould's weekend back in the old neighborhood. And then he goes on and he spends the weekend with his sister, played by Patti LuPone, and her husband, played by Jack Willis. And they go back through the attic, as it were, of their childhood, which was apparently not a very diverting time. And it comes out that Bobby is in the midst of some life crisis, and comes back to the old neighborhood as you and I and everybody else goes back to the attic and finds themselves taking out that old box full of scraps when we're in the midst of a change in our life. And at the end of this play, he's driven to go back and find what he didn't have before, which is to meet with the woman whom he didn't marry, whom he loved but didn't marry, and to finish out his weekend in the old neighborhood by trying to put some closure, to try to put some direction on his life. He goes back to her for an answer, and she gives him one. And that's the play.
Do you have sensations like this when you go back to your old neighborhood in Chicago?
Sure.
How often do you go? Do you still have any family there that would draw you back?
Oh, yeah, my stepmother's there. And I was just back there a couple of months ago, and I was walking by the lake, and the smell of Lake Michigan hit me, and I was overcome by... I thought I knew what nostalgia meant, but I didn't. I was overcome by this almost debilitating... I hope I'm using Mr. Sartre's term correctly, nausea. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's also from Chicago and describing the situation to him. And he said, yeah, he said, that happened to me too. I said, so I thought that nostalgia was a longing for the past, or kind of bittersweet Weltschmerz, a gushy feeling. But I find that that's not true at all, and that it does mean the pain of the past.
When you say the pain of the past, is it because the past was painful or because it's painful that you've lost the past?
I think more the second, because, I mean, all the memories I had walking around that neighborhood in the North Side were happy and provocative, but the overwhelming effect, the important effect, was one of loss.
What do you do when you're overcome like that? I mean, do you just try to, like, stay in that moment or shake it?
I don't know. I think I came back east, and I think I thought about it for a while and talked to several people about it, and just it wouldn't go away. There's no thought of overcoming it.
Yeah. Do you have friends like Bobby Gould in the play has who stayed in the old neighborhood and have shown you a kind of, like, alternate existence, what life would have been like for someone who stayed?
Sure.
And anything you wish you had about that?
Oh, of course. Of course, absolutely.
What?
The Lake Michigan and the old pubs and the old people and the old life. Of course, the old life wouldn't have been the old life because I would have grown to this age in that environment. But I think that's what nostalgia is I can never be a fireman, you know, as the ancient Greeks used to say.
Do you have that kind of box of old stuff that you keep?
Sure.
How do you decide what to keep and throw away? I mean, I moved recently, and it was really a crisis. I had a friend who was moving, too, and I love the way she put it. She said, you have to interrogate every object in your life and ask it, do you matter to me? Do you matter to me enough to keep you? If I'm not keeping you, do I want to sell you? Do I want to give you away? And there's this kind of crisis of the emotional attachment to every object you own when you're moving and you're trying to just kind of like throw out excess baggage but keep the things that really matter. And then you wonder, why is it so important to keep certain like objects? And then you realize, well, it's because they evoke these feelings. But the feelings they evoke aren't always good, so you wonder.
Indeed. Well, we aren't rational creatures, you know. We're creatures whose life takes, and perhaps I can use this as a segue to tie together several of the things which I've been working on, which you've been kind enough to refer to today, that perhaps our lives take place on a level much, much deeper and more interesting than the rational, and that's what art's about.
Yeah, well, that kind of sums it up, I guess.
I guess that puts you to sleep, huh?
Yeah, no, on the contrary.
Starbucks time, right?
No, I guess I'm wondering, how often do you go to those, like, memory boxes? And
I go to them about 8 hours a day.
Oh, you mean to write? You mean you're drawing that to write? Yeah, right. Have you saved old writing, like really old writing?
I saved everything.
You have?
Yeah, sure.
And when you look at it, when you look at that stuff from, say, high school or college, are you proud of it?
Oh, God, I'd never look at it again.
Oh, you saved it, but you wouldn't look at it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, one has to draw the line somewhere.
Were you saving it for the David Mamet archives or?
No, hell no. I'm just saving it because why would one want to throw it out? But on the other hand, why would one want to look at it?
One would throw it out to prevent oneself from having to endure looking at it and reading it.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt that if I looked through that stuff, I would probably even find a poem where I rhymed rain and window pane. And if I say probably, but if I found that actually to be the case, how could I go on?
Right. That's David Mamet, and his new book about acting is called True and False. His new novel is called The Old Religion. His play, The Old Neighborhood, begins previews on Broadway November 11th.